July 5th, 2020. Happy day after the 4th. Did you know Missouri spends more money on fireworks than any other state? Almost twice as much as number 2 Alabama. With no displays to go to, we contributed about $55 to the $51 million we spent this year. Looked like my neighbor won a bet. Who needs to battle traffic? Best tweet of the week. Okay, walk with me on this one. So, KU fan Blunt Force Trauma throws out this tweet. We shouldn't be playing Missouri in anything. That was a horrifically bad decision. I no longer donate to KU as a result. And then Jeff Long, KU's AD, replies, and this is when I have grown to appreciate Twitter. Sorry you feel that way. We disagree with your position, but respect your viewpoint. Also seeing that your next donation will be your first donation, so thanks in advance for your support. Then Jeff, about 5 minutes later, had to backtrack a little bit. His tweet, just joking, it's been a tough 4 months. I do understand that not all Jayhawks fans agree with the decision and truly do respect those who disagree. Just trying to have some fun, and I apologize if I offended you or anyone else. Rock chalk and good night. It might be a while before I applaud anything Kansas does again, but touche, Mr. Long, touche. This podcast's Twitter account is, the account for the podcast is at OT with Oliver if you want to follow or have some dialogue back and forth. On that note, if you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe and or write a review. When you do that, it helps me get in front of some more ears. So if you do that, thank you. Three things you should if you have not. There's this little play I discovered on Disney Plus. You probably haven't heard much about it, but I'm going to throw my weight behind this thing and see if it catches on. You know the drill. I endorse it. Overtimers spread the word, and we make the world a better place. My little nugget is something named Alexander Hamilton. Now I know, David, another documentary review. No, that's coming next. This is a play filmed in 2016. All right. Here's the thing. If sold-out shows or $200 tickets kept you from seeing Hamilton live, go out and get a free Disney Plus trial if all you do is see this. That's how good the play is. Set to Eminem like rapping, it kept my attention the full 2 hours, 55 minutes. Number 2, Netflix doc. You knew it was coming. David Foster, Off the Record. If you're a regular listener, you know I really enjoyed the doc Quincy, his daughter Rashida, put together for Netflix in September 18. So I'm thinking David Foster, the white Quincy Jones, this could be good. I mean, the man absolutely has the catalog, but what do you think these artists have in common? Celine Dion. Michael Bolton. Barbara Streisand. Michael Bublé. Josh Groban. Kenny G. Melba Toast. Took about 40 minutes to get interesting, but then it was worth it. Great story about how Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You got in the film Bodyguard. One guest who ran over Ben Vereen at 2 a.m. in Malibu and saved his life. Don't lose any sleep if you miss it, but your perseverance will be rewarded. Lastly, KSDK's On Your Side weekdays 4 p.m. with the incomparable Art Holiday. If you're not home, tape it. Not just a preview of the 5 and 6 telecasts, Art and Kay Quinn do a great job. Born and raised in St. Louis, Art has seen our fair city at its worst and best. With career options, Art chose to come back home to be near family, and after 40-plus years has been part of the solution. Great Mizzou memories, great behind-the-scenes KSDK stories. It's also about time we find out more about Art Holiday, the film director. Fun conversation.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And now another episode of Overtime with Oliver. We are happy and excited to sit down and have a little chat with Art Holiday, 40 plus years at KSDK.
Next month will be my 41st anniversary at the radio, at the TV station. I've been doing radio at KTRS for almost a year and a half with my longtime TV co-anchor, Jennifer Blome. These are interesting times, David.
Longest tenure ever at KSDK, question mark?
I don't know. I can say that officially, probably. I'm trying to think of somebody who might have been there. I mean, I know we have some behind-the-scenes people that have probably been there longer than I have. But in terms of in front of the camera, my guess is probably would be my best answer.
That'd be mine. At Overtime with Oliver, we like to think that we document the important people, places, and events in St. Louis.
kind of hard to do a podcast if you're framing it that way without Art Holliday. So thanks for the time, man.
You're very welcome.
Grew up in St. Charles, 6th and Morgan.
Yes.
And what do you remember about growing up in St. Charles at 6th and Morgan?
Well, I remember a lot of things. My parents lived at that location for over 60 years before they died. My grandfather was a minister, and ministers get different assignments over time and move from city to city. And at one point, he moved to St. Charles, and that's when my father and my uncles settled in St. Charles. You know, it was like most places, it's a mixed bag. You know, that you have good memories, you have bad memories. I recently did a commentary on the TV station. They asked me to share my story in the context of race and growing up in St. Charles. And, you know, there were some things that I wish hadn't happened. You know, I told a story about, you know, we were the only Black family on my block for many blocks around in St. Charles, and always had a great relationship with our neighbors. But I told the story about when I was probably about 5 years old, I was in my backyard playing, and I noticed that there was several houses over, there was a big block party with all of our neighbors, and we were the only family that wasn't invited. And I kept staring at them and wondering, you know, why weren't we there? And then finally my mother came out in the backyard, made me come in the house. I guess she was afraid I was making our neighbors uncomfortable. I'm not sure. She didn't really say. And, you know, periodically we'd have people drive by the house and yell stuff. And, you know, one time, this was after I had left St. Charles and I was working at Channel 5, but I was visiting, and my daughter was probably about 5 years old. And, you know, somebody drove by and yelled the N-word, and my daughter could tell that everybody was upset, but she didn't know why. And, you know, being the smart, perceptive child that she wasn't taking no for an answer. And so I had to explain to my daughter that, you know, sometimes people don't like you because of the way you look, even though they don't know anything about you. On the flip side of that, I had a lot of great teachers who were very supportive of me. I think I had made some sort of presentation in my sixth grade class, and my teacher decided at that moment to tell me and the rest of the class that I could be anything that I wanted to be. And when you're 12 years old, you don't necessarily have a great appreciation of that, but looking back on it, I recognize it for what it was. He was trying to encourage me. And, you know, when your teacher has high expectations, then sometimes that can make an impact. And the opposite is true also. If your teacher has low expectations, you know, sometimes you live down to that. Fortunately, you know, my teacher was trying to lift me up.
What was the name of that teacher?
Mrs. Bluebaugh.
And you have a daughter that's a teacher, correct?
Yeah, she's an elementary school teacher. She's followed in my wife's footsteps. My wife is a career educator and former assistant superintendent. And so, yeah, she's a very dedicated teacher and gets rave reviews from students and parents. So I'm very proud of her.
I was going to say, what's the subject? Did I miss what subject it was?
She teaches elementary. She's a first grade teacher right now. She goes back and forth. She has the same students 2 years in a row. So this year she'll have her first graders in second grade.
And not that there's anything better about being a teacher, but my oldest, Rebecca, second year teacher now, teaching English in Omaha. And I just love it when people ask me what she does.
Well, anyone who's had any success at all in life has one or more teachers to thank for it. And if the pandemic taught us anything, since so many parents got to be teachers and weren't expecting to do it, I think there is a great, much greater appreciation for the role that teachers play. I think a lot of people take it for granted. They think it's, in some ways, it's easy. There's nothing easy about being a teacher. And the pandemic, we appreciate a lot more people than maybe we used to. The delivery people, certainly first responders and hospital personnel, but let's put teachers in that category. You know, parents can't wait for schools to start up again, and hopefully it'll be safe.
Where'd you go to high school, Art?
St. Charles High School, 1972.
Did you hoop?
I played basketball and football. I was extremely average. I was really skinny in high school. I was 6'3 and 150 pounds my senior year. I didn't start gaining weight until I was almost out of college. So my claim to fame in football is that I got to play with a guy who played 9 years in the NFL, Curtis Brown, who distinguished himself at Mizzou and then later went on to get drafted by the Buffalo Bills and became a trivia question. He replaced O.J. Simpson in the Buffalo Bills backfield when Simpson was traded, I think, to the L.A. Rams, if I'm not mistaken. But
might have been San Francisco 49ers?
Might have been. I can't really remember. Yeah, I think you're right, actually, yeah.
So you and I both went to the best journalism school in the country?
We did. We did. We just had the dean of the J School on, I guess it was yesterday, David Kerpius. You know, I was telling him that in, I think it was 2008, when they had the centennial of the J School, I recognized that I was part of something, number one, that's over a century old. It's the first journalism school in the world. The list of alumni and their accomplishments is amazing. I mean, I look back at some of my classmates. One went on to be the managing editor of USA Today. Another was a CBS News correspondent. Another was executive producer of Entertainment Tonight. And it's been really fun following the careers of some of those people. Of course, I work with Matt Weiner at KSDK. He's a Mizzou grad, has done in his post KSDK days. You know, he went on to a long career at ESPN. I believe he's with Turner now. You know, so I mean, there's just example after example of what that journalism school has meant to a lot of different people. And certainly I'm in that category. I mean, whatever success I've had got started at the J School in Mizzou.
You know, that used to be more prevalent. They had the term Mizzou Mafia. Might have been Mizzou right. Mafia at the time. And this is before me. Maybe it's more you. When cable news first started to explode, you couldn't swing a dead cat and not have a Missouri graduate producing the show.
Right, and that's probably still true. I mean, I suspect that certainly many newsrooms, if not most newsrooms in the country, have a Mizzou grad working there. I mean, we're all over the place. So, of course, you know, it's a bit of a challenge being a journalist right now. You know, we're not always held in the highest esteem, but, you know, we still have the ability to do important things and hold the powerful accountable. And without that, I think society would be the lesser for it.
Who is Lee Wilson?
Lee Wilson was the head of the broadcast department at Mizzou when I was there and had a huge influence. Lee was a network photographer, producer, documentary filmmaker. He came up through the ranks with Tom Brokaw. I believe they worked together in Omaha, and then eventually both made it to the network. And I believe Lee worked for all three major networks. And so when I was at KOMU, he was in charge of the broadcasting department. And after my first year in J school, I made an appointment to see him because I wanted to ask him about getting a summer internship and what the value of that would be and any suggestions he might have. And he talked me out of doing an internship. He said, why don't you enroll in summer school? I'll make you a TA, you'll earn some money. You know, we got some spots open on our newscast. He put me in the sports anchor chair 5 nights a week. And while I had his attention during this scheduled meeting, I asked him, you know, the question that, you know, every J school student has at some point, especially in the early days, have I made the right decision? Do I have what it takes? And I valued his opinion so much that, you know, had he been less than, you know, complimentary and encouraging, it would have been, you know, I don't want to get melodramatic here, but it would have been borderline devastating if he didn't think that, you know, I had what it takes. But he said, no, you know, that's why I'm telling you, you know, if you get an internship, you'll be doing grunt work. Come to summer school, you're on TV 5 nights a week. You can work on your anchoring. You're a TA. Blah, blah, blah. And I've been forever grateful. And I thanked him multiple times over the years because he had that one meeting just really, I mean, it really jump-started my confidence. I think there may be a handful of journalism students who are confident the whole time, but most of us are just kind of muddling around and making our mistakes on the radio and on television and suffering through those growing pains, and that was me. And so I needed to hear from someone that I respected that, you know, they thought I could do this. And so that was a big turning point for me.
And what's great about Mizzou, and you mentioned KOMU, is the students, for the most part, they're running the NBC affiliate. So yes, yes. Stories are breaking and things are going on, you're learning on the fly. And people laugh at me who are 10 years older than me because I try to explain to them how we used to edit the videotape. But right. You told me the story about you actually have film. How'd you get that done in 30 minutes?
Well, I had a bit of an advantage because in high school, in my contemporary literature class, I had an independent project and I decided to make a short film. It wasn't anything great. You know, it was just some kids playing after school, and I put a little music with it, but I had to learn how to edit and learn that a certain length of film equals a certain period of time, which is, that's the whole basis of editing film, especially news film, when you're trying to get it to match what the copy says. And so when I got to Mizzou and I had my introductory broadcasting class, they handed all of us a reel of film and a script, and we had, I don't know, 20 minutes or so to edit it and make it match the film. And when it was my turn for the instructor to see what I had done, you know, we're reading along, boom, 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 every edit hit because I knew what I was doing. And the instructor, Max Huesler, who I just recently communicated with because he received some honor at KU, where he's an instructor now, he was like, you know, giving me a shout out in front of the class because he said that didn't happen very often, you know, right in your very first editing assignment. But I, you know, so I had that advantage.
Did they have a tool or was it a razor blade?
Man, you're really testing my memory. You do realize this is 1973, right? So anything I tell you, there's the fog of time involved. You know, it may have been a razor blade. I honestly don't really remember. You know, I know they just told us that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, John Wooden, what did he say? Be quick, but don't hurry. To his basketball players. And that's kind of the secret of editing. You know, you are usually on the deadline, but you don't want to get in too much of a hurry because if your splice breaks, everything on that big reel behind that break in the film may not get on the air. And so that was one of the early lessons that I learned, you know, be quick, but don't be in a hurry.
After a rough night, what was your go-to breakfast at Brady Commons?
I really don't have any great Brady Commons stories to tell you. One memory that I have very distinctly, like many people, I'm a fan of Saturday Night Live, but I was at Mizzou the very first season of Saturday Night Live, and I was working weekends at KOMU, and so after the 10 o'clock news, we'd gather around the TV until Weekend Update came on, you know, the fake news, and then if those of us who were of age, you know, we'd head out to Ford Theater or Deja Vu or wherever and, you know, start getting our drink on. But that's one memory that I have very distinctly. You know, we all hung around the newsroom until Weekend Update was over.
First job out of college was Oklahoma City?
Yeah, that was a different experience because I stayed an extra semester at Mizzou to get some additional on-air seasoning, as well as reporting and shooting and editing and all of that, but mainly on-air. And a guy named Jerry Orr, who had been a grad student while I was an undergrad, came back to campus for homecoming and crashed overnight at the house that I was renting with several other guys. And he told me about a job that he had turned down in Oklahoma City. And it was a weekend sports job. And he said, I think it's still open, so you might want to contact the news director. So mid-semester, I contacted the news director and he asked for a tape. And I guess it was okay because he asked for another tape and I didn't have one. I only had one audition tape. So I had to make another one. I sent it to him. And I didn't know any better when he came to Columbia to interview me. I thought, well, I guess this is the way it works. You know, you make a connection, the news director comes to you. Well, he wanted to check out the J school. And so we went out to dinner and he interviewed me and I wound up getting the job. So 3 weeks before I graduated, I knew that I had a job in a top 40 market as a weekend sportscaster. And so, you know, that's how I wound up in Oklahoma City. At the time, I didn't know any better. I thought you sent out two tapes, the news director came to interview you at school, and you wound up with a job in the 38th market. It wasn't until I started comparing notes with, you know, other classmates that, oh, wow, okay. So I guess this is not the way it works for everybody.
Hey, Art, my first job out of college, I was in Frankfort, Indiana, and I lived on Hot Dog Avenue. All right, so we're in Oklahoma City. We don't need to get into this all the time. I'm just trying to touch bases on stuff. You had an unfortunately awkward conversation right off the bat with one of the sales reps.
Yeah, I had been there, I don't know, maybe several months. And I was in the break room of a TV station. And a salesman that I had never spoken to before just walked up to me and boldly asked me if I thought I was hired because I was black. And, you know, I was momentarily taken aback. You know, I mean, that's a pretty rude question. I mean, you're making a big assumption, like I don't have any skills. You know, if I had a do-over, you know, first of all, I'd tell this gentleman that, first of all, I'm a graduate of one of the best journalism schools in the country. But my answer was short and sweet. I said, why don't you go ask the news director who hired me? I got the job. But as I've replayed that moment over and over again in my head, I recognize it for what it is. You know, this guy was just totally disregarding me, making assumptions because of the way I look, having no idea what my background was, the educational foundation that I had. I wish I could have that same conversation over again. I would have had a lot to say.
Before you move back to St. Louis and spend more than four decades in your hometown, you almost took a job in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I was about 3 years into my Oklahoma City adventure, and you know, I was looking for other opportunities, and there was a sportscasting job in Tampa at the NBC station. And I flew down there and interviewed, and things went very well. They were ready to hire me. In the meantime, before I said yes, I got a call from the Mizzou Mafia, one of my classmates at Mizzou, Rick Evers, and he was working at KSD TV then. And he said, that Jay Randolph and Ron Jacober, the two sportscasters then, were looking for a weekend sportscaster. And if I was interested, send a tape. So before I knew it, I had two job offers. And the strange thing about the whole situation was one of my professional goals, or probably more personal goals, I wanted to work in a warm weather city by the water. I thought that for a young single guy, the opportunity to go to the beach and work in a warm weather climate was very appealing. There it was. I mean, it was right there on a platter. All I had to do was say yes. But I knew what it would mean to my parents if I came home and they were able to watch me on TV multiple times a week. And I completely underestimated what it meant to them. I mean, they got so much joy and pleasure, and you know, they were treated like celebrities in St. Charles because of my job. And then later on, much later, when both of my parents were in a nursing home in their final years, I was glad that I was a quote unquote celebrity in St. Louis because of them. I don't know for sure, but I hope that them being my parents meant they got a little bit extra care in their final day.
I never worked for Jay Randolph. To me, seemed like one of the most generous people I ever knew.
Well, Jay was and is a character. He was an extremely versatile sports broadcaster, had a number of assignments with NBC. He was in and out of town all the time, which meant that Ron Jacober and I got a lot of extra anchoring in, probably Ron more so than me, but, you know, Jay was traveling a lot. You know, he broadcasted for the Cardinals, he did golf for NBC, he did horse racing for NBC, he did football for NBC. And, you know, so I just learned a lot just by observing him. And Ron Jacober was one of the best writers that I had come in contact with at that point. And I really paid a lot of attention to his writing ability. And that rubbed off on me. That's something that I take a tremendous amount of pride in, is my ability to write. And so, you know, getting a chance to work with, and plus I had grown up watching both of them, you know, and, you know, so that was pretty cool as well. And I'm covering my hometown team. I mean, the first time one of my early reporting assignments after I took the job in 79, I believe it was a preseason Mizzou football news conference type deal. And I can't remember who the coach was in 79, but the coach was there. But I'm looking around the room, and Mike Shannon was there, and Jack Buck was there, and Bob Bragg and Bob Burns, the sports editors of the Globe and the Post-Dispatch, were both there. You know, so I'm looking around at all of these people that I had grown up listening to and watching and reading, and, you know, I was probably 24, maybe 25. And, you know, it's like that, you know, who doesn't belong in here? Raise your hand, you know, and my hand is the only one that's up, right? And, you know, it's just one of those moments where you You're kind of, you're pinching yourself, but you're also questioning being in the same room with people who have already arrived at where you hope to be someday. And, you know, it was a pretty humbling experience.
Did Julius Hunter ever reach out to you?
Well, I mean, he was one of my early role models. If I was coming out of high school now, I would probably go to film school. I wanted to be a filmmaker, but I didn't, you know, Spike Lee hadn't come along. John Singleton hadn't come along. There weren't any role models. So there was no reason for me to think, you know, that I could be a filmmaker or a documentary filmmaker or a cinematographer or anything like that, because I didn't see anybody who looked like me doing it. But I did see Julius Hunter every night. I did see Ed Bradley reporting from Vietnam and the White House and, you know, later on 60 Minutes. And so being a broadcast journalist seemed much more attainable because I did have role models. And so, yeah, our paths have crossed many times over the years. Probably the last time was less than a year ago. We hung out and, you know, Julius is retired now. And we were just talking and catching up, and he was asking me a lot of things about my career. And, you know, and I explained what I just explained to you, how much of a role model he had been for me.
So your first 10 years in sports, you interview everybody. I don't want to, like, say, hey, you interviewed Wayne Gretzky. Good for you. Everybody interviews Wayne Gretzky. I've never met anybody who interviewed Sugar Ray Leonard. What was that like?
Well, he started asking me questions about the Sphinx Brothers. Because, well, obviously, you know, they had both Michael and Leon were champions as professionals. And so he was asking me questions. And then, you know, he's just a really charismatic interview. I don't even remember. I'm trying to remember if he was still boxing then or if he had retired already. But yeah, I mean, that's one of those, definitely one of the interviews that stands out. I got to interview John McEnroe when he was at the height of his tennis career. There was the U.S. played Sweden in a Davis Cup tie here in St. Louis. And there was a really famous match at the, I don't know if it was the arena at the time or
the Checkerdome,
but they had John McEnroe and Mats Wilander played a 6.5-hour singles match because they didn't have a tiebreaker in the fifth set and neither guy could put the other guy away. So I was the weekend sportscaster. I watched a long portion of the match from the sports office. And then after the 6 o'clock news, I drove out there and the match was still going on. And then eventually I had to go back to the TV station and the match was still going on. And so that, you know, that was my lead story that night. And prior to the match, they had a news conference with Arthur Ashe and John McEnroe. And Arthur Ashe had been a childhood hero of mine. He's the reason I started playing tennis when I was back in high school. You know, so that was a thrill. Yeah, I mean, you know, we had the football Cardinals then. Obviously, we had the baseball Cardinals. We had the Blues. And, you know, so I got to cover, you know, Bernie Federko and Brian Sutter when they were both playing with the Blues. Jim Hart, Roger Worley, Dan Dierdorf with the Cardinals, Neil Lomax and Otis Anderson, you know, a lot of those players before the team left in 89. So, I mean, and I interviewed Michael Jordan three separate times. He was, I think the North Carolina, this was, I think the year after they won the title when he hit the game-winning shot. So it would have been his sophomore year. I think they were in town to play Mizzou, if I'm not mistaken. And so, you know, we did one of those talkback things where through the at the, you know, their media person. You just had Michael Jordan standing up, probably standing outside the hotel with an IFB in his ear, and I interviewed him from the set about, you know, what was going on with him. Of course, you know, he wasn't quite Michael Jordan yet, but the legend was underway. And then later on, I interviewed him his rookie season in the NBA because the Bulls played an exhibition game here in St. Louis. And then several years later, there was a, I think this was during the VP Fair, and I believe Coca-Cola arranged for a number of NBA players to come into town as part of the VP Fair. So they blocked off the street in front of the arch and put up a basket. And so Michael Jordan was playing, Johnny Dawkins was playing, Roy Green of the Football Cardinals was playing, Patrick Ewing was in that game. And I went out there and I did a story about the first time all these guys dunked. And for some of them, it was, you know, most of them, it was middle school. And they were reminiscing about the very first time they dunked and what it meant to them. So that was the angle that I took.
You know, I've got a why Art Holliday is a nice guy story. I was an intern at KSDK in 89. And during VP Fair that you were just mentioning, I would take you and other anchors around on those golf carts that we had.
Right, right.
And that was when a billion people went to VP Fair. And so we're driving around in these go-karts, and these masses of people are just being totally unruly and not respecting your space whatsoever. And you would just sit there and you thank them for their listeners or their viewership and let them know, look, I'm sorry, I can't talk. I really got to get down the arch in the next 5 minutes.
Well, that reminds me of something that Jack Buck once told me. I asked him, what do you tell young broadcasters? I'm sure you get asked questions from starstruck young broadcasters all the time. And I was struck by his reply. He said, if you don't enjoy being around people, then do something else. Because if you have any level of success in this business as a broadcaster, people are going to want to meet you, to shake your hand, to have their moment with you. And if you're a jerk, and you're acting like, you know, you're too big to talk to them, all you're going to do is make yourself miserable, and you're going to make these people who idolize you and just want to talk to you and just want a moment of your time, you're going to make them miserable, and you're going to make your organization, you're going to make your employer look bad. And I thought that was great advice because, you know, I'm sure both of us have seen people who – they get the big head after they have some success and they start treating people like crap. And it, I mean, why wouldn't you listen to Jack Buck about anything, right? So, I mean, that's one of my favorite Jack Buck stories.
So during my internship is also when you took the step in the mornings, and I'm not speaking out of school. I just remember you weren't super, super excited about having to wake up that early in the morning.
Well, there were a lot of things going on. Number one, I thought I was going to be a sportscaster my whole career. My goal was to eventually be the sports director at KSDK. I loved what I was doing. I mean, I was covering my hometown teams. The 80s was an amazing decade to be a sportscaster. I mean, I got to cover Whitey Ball. I mean, you know, we mentioned all these other people, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard and John McEnroe. I mean, getting to cover Whitey Herzog and Willie McGee and Ozzie Smith and John Tudor and Tommy Herr, I mean, that's one of the signature decades of Cardinal baseball. So in 89, I get called to the principal's office up on the third floor, the general manager, right? You know, and I'm trying to think, okay, what did I do wrong? Why am I getting called upstairs? And it was built, the name of the GM was Bill Bolster at the time. And he said, we're going to make some changes on our morning show. And I think you'd make a great co-anchor for Jennifer Blow. Now, this is entirely your decision. You don't have to feel any pressure to do anything just because I'm asking you to do it. And I'm thinking to myself the whole time, well, if this isn't a trap, I don't know what is. You know, it's always a good idea to agree with your boss's idea. And I was afraid to say no. So before I knew it, I was anchoring a 30-minute morning show from 6:30 to 7 right before the Today Show with Jennifer Blohm. The good news is Jennifer and I started the same year in 79, and we both work weekends together. I didn't know her well, but she wasn't a stranger to me. Now, I doubt that Bill Bolster thought he was assembling a 22-year anchor team, but that's what happened. And over time, Today in St. Louis became one of the most successful local morning shows in the country. There were, at our peak, we had the highest ratings in the country. And the corporation was treating us like rock stars. We were Gannett then, we're Tegna now, but then it was Gannett. We had other Gannett producers calling, wanting to know what our secret was. And we just looked at each other and laughed because our secret was we made each other laugh, whether we were at our desk in the newsroom or we were on the set. And we just became friends. And in fact, the first couple of times we had laughing jags, we thought they were going to fire us. And the audience gave us permission to be ourselves. You know, I mean, we just had similar senses of humor, and we recognized just how kind of ludicrous it is to be doing news early in the morning when you're half asleep and, you know, you're sleep deprived, and stuff that ordinarily wouldn't be funny almost puts you on the floor. And, you know, we forget there's still a camera pointed at us. But that became one of our, you know, one of our trademarks. But, you know, we took our job seriously, but we didn't take ourselves seriously. And we just try to include the audience in on the joke and the laughter. And you know, and then, you know, along came Scott Connell, and, you know, Jennifer called him Cubby. And that stuck because he looked so young at the time. You know, I don't know what Bill Bolster saw in me that made him think that I was the right choice for that. Clearly he was right. And I had a front row seat to the explosion of local early morning television. When I left the show 22 years later, it was a 3-hour show. When I started, it was a 30-minute show. You know, and, you know, everybody in the country had an early morning newscast. I mean, we were one of the early adopters when it came to that. Bill Bolster was kind of a visionary when he started our morning newscast. And, you know, it turned out to be a pretty big deal.
So you've worked with Jennifer for 22 plus years. Art, how long have you been married?
Let me do the math. I got married in 82. So August will be my 38th anniversary. Yeah.
How did you propose?
Well, I wish I had a great proposal story, but we had been dating for a while. You know, the better story is how we met on our first date. I was doing weekend sports, and I got off on Saturday night. You know, I'm young and single. What do you do when you're young and single on a Saturday night? Sometimes you hit the clubs, right? So I was at the point in the interstate where either I was going to go home or I was going to, you know, go have a couple of pops, right? And so at the last minute, I decide I'm going to go hang out and, you know, and have a couple of drinks and then go home. And as it turned out, my wife-to-be was coaxed by her friends to come out that night. She didn't have any plans to go out, but they made her. And we met and chatted after making eye contact and talked and we wound up hanging out until the wee hours of the morning, listening to David Bowie. She wanted to see what my musical tastes were like, and we were already both David Bowie fans, so we were listening to David Bowie by candlelight. And so first date, we go out for pizza, and my wife was and is one of the funniest people that I know. Her sense of humor is off the charts, and I had just taken a sip of wine, and she said something funny, and I spit sprayed wine on her. And when I told my, years later, when we told our daughter that story, my daughter's like, "And you went out with him again?" And I said, "Yeah, that's how strong my game was. I overcame spit spraying wine on your mom."
What was the name of the bar?
It was called Goombas. And it was connected to an Italian restaurant called Godfather's. It was at 270 in Dorset. They tore down that building a long time ago. But every time I drive by 270 in Dorset, I think, oh, that was the scene of the crime.
All right, so you're too humble. We're going to, well, before we get to the documentaries and stuff that I want to touch base on, dude, man, Hall of Fame, Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists, recipient of Annual Media Award for the National Affiliation of Mental Health, selection to the University of Missouri Columbia Faculty Alumni Award, introduction to the St. Louis Media Foundation Television Hall of Fame, and on and on and on. Here's my question. You got three Emmys.
Mm-hmm.
You got one for a sports feature. Was it the Whitey Herzog three-piece deal? Was that what you won the award for?
No. And I'm not even sure that got submitted. It's been so long ago. But it was for, I went to spring training, and I wanted to do a piece about the fans who build their whole vacation around spring training. And, everything just kind of clicked. We had some great footage, and, we did some interesting sound editing. We had a fan that said, this woman, I love the crack of the bat. And then we had Willie McGee in the cage, and we intercut, three quick swings, and then we went back to the woman. Oh, that's how I know spring training was started. And, so we had some cool fans, and then you always hope for a happy accident when you're doing a feature story, right? We got this little kid was in a wheelchair, and he was trying to get the attention of players to get autographs. And we were close enough to get some really good Nat sound of him. And I wish I could remember which player it was, but he was having an ongoing conversation with one of the Cardinal players. And you could tell from the look on his face that this had just made his year, and he would remember that for the rest of his life. And then, with some halfway decent writing, it wound up being a really strong piece, and I submitted it, and it was it won an Emmy for Best Sports Feature.
Fast forward to 2003, why did you make Before I Fall Off the Cliff?
I had, as I mentioned earlier, I always had an interest in filmmaking. And as my broadcasting career continued, that was still kind of a generic idea. I knew eventually I wanted to do some long form storytelling, but I didn't know what it was going to be. And Jennifer Blome has a brother with mental illness. And so she had done a number of stories about mental illness. So she was really kind of tapped into the local mental health community. And she emceed an event where Mark McBride was getting an award for his advocacy. And the McBride family had become known for the worst case scenario of serious mental illness. Mark McBride's younger brother, Matt, in the early 90s, had severe paranoid schizophrenia, which ran in the McBride family. Matt's aunt, his mother's sister, had schizophrenia. So the mother predicted to the rest of her family that she was going to die at the hands of her son. And she was right. He was mistakenly released from a psychiatric hospital, and the hospital was supposed to call the family to warn them. It's called a duty to warn order, so that they would know that he was no longer hospitalized. And he was completely delusional, hearing voices that told him that his parents were going to start World War III, and he had to kill them in order to save the world. And that's what he thought he was doing when he stabbed both of his parents to death. And so this was a very sensational story in St. Louis, and it got national play. And a lot of national news organizations were trying to get the McBrides to allow them to tell their story, including Dateline and I think 60 Minutes. And Mark McBride turned them all down. And he told all this to Jennifer, and she said, well, my co-anchor, Art Holliday, is interested in making documentaries. Maybe you should talk to him. And so she invited us both over to her home. And he said the reason that he allowed me to tell the family story is because I was the only one who listened. He said, you know, all the network big shots were, you know, telling him what they were going to do, and this is what we need you to do. And he was afraid that they were going to try to sensationalize a story that was already sensational. You know, a son stabbing both of his parents. And, you know, I mean, they had over 40 stab wounds. It was a slaughter. When I started making the film, some of the crime scene photos I couldn't use. They were horrific. And, you know, at first I was going to do this big film about paranoid schizophrenia and talk to a lot of experts and, you know, you know, and then obviously, you know, through the lens of Matt McBride, who was now, he was declared incompetent to stand trial. And so he was incarcerated at the Fulton State Hospital. I started working with a woman who works with documentary filmmakers. She's called the documentary doctor. And basically, she just kind of talks you through the process to help you with your decision making. And so when I went to New York to work with her, and we looked at my rough cut several times, she said, there's nothing wrong with all the experts and everything, but you've got three really powerful voices in your film. You've got the young man who's mentally ill and doesn't believe he deserves to live because he destroyed his own family. And you've got the two older siblings who have educated themselves about mental illness, and they've forgiven their brother, and they're trying to help him regain his sanity. It's your decision, but to me, that's the story. And I thought about it, and I think she was right. And so ultimately, I told a story about three siblings and the challenges of, you know, forgiving a family member when they commit a crime because they can't help it. And so ultimately, that became Before They Fall Off the Cliff, the ripple effect of schizophrenia. The title came from something Mark McBride always said. He said the problem with mental health care in the U.S. is once you commit a crime, you get all the help you need because you're incarcerated and they force you to take antipsychotic medication. So when do you need the help? Before you fall off the cliff? Or afterwards. And so that's where the title came from.
I know you got a low fuel tank right now. You got another 5-10 minutes?
Sure.
Okay. Johnny B. Goode, how important was the Chuck Berry documentary Hail Hail Rock and Roll for you and being able to look into Johnny Johnson?
Well, I was at the tail end of the McBride documentary, And so it was a very challenging documentary on many levels. I mean, I had to ask a family to relive the worst time of their life on camera. And then there were some other challenges. And so I just wanted to get through that documentary, and I wasn't even thinking about another one. But, you know, sometimes opportunity shows up in disguise at a time when you don't expect it, right? So one of my colleagues at Channel 5, a photographer named Tony Chambers, stopped by my desk, and he knew I was a music fan. So he was telling me about how a friend of his was producing an album with Johnny Johnson, and how Bonnie Raitt was on it, and John Sebastian was on it, and Johnny Rivers and some other people. And, you know, we were just chatting, and he literally had started to walk away from my desk to get on with his day. And he turned around and he said, "I know you're into making documentaries. Johnny Johnson might make an interesting documentary." Well, you know, months went by and the idea started to marinate. And then I started researching Johnny. I knew a little bit of his story, but not really a lot. And it dawned on me, this guy was in the delivery room when rock and roll was born. When's the next time that opportunity is going to come along? And then there's the whole songwriting controversy with Chuck Berry that, you know, Keith Richards brought up in the Hail Hell rock and roll film that you mentioned. And in fact, in my documentary, that's the turning point in Johnny's life, because after his long relationship with Chuck Berry, Chuck stopped touring with a regular band because he didn't like band members who drank and did drugs, and Johnny drank heavily. And so Chuck would just travel from city to city and pick up whatever musicians he could, because his thinking was, well, everybody knows how to play Chuck Berry songs if they're any kind of musician. You know, Bruce Springsteen was one of those musicians before he became the Boss. And he tells a hilarious story in Hail Hail Rock and Roll about being part of Chuck Berry's backup band one night. But, you know, by the mid-1980s, Johnny had kind of been forgotten, and a lot of music fans didn't even know if he was alive. And he wasn't making a living as a musician. In the documentary, I tell this story about Keith Richards and the first keyboard player in the Rolling Stones in the early 60s, a guy named Ian Stewart, who was a piano historian. And he knew who Johnny Johnson was and the influence that he had on Chuck Berry's sound. And that's how the Rolling Stones found out about Johnny Johnson, was from their piano player, Ian Stewart. So fast forward to the mid-1980s, a few months before Ian Stewart dies, he pulls aside Keith Richards. And it's the most random conversation. He says, "Don't forget, Johnny Johnson's still alive and playing in St. Louis. You need to go find him." And Keith Richards looked at him like, "What the hell are you talking about? I mean, this conversation just came out of the blue." So Ian Stewart dies. Not long after that, Taylor Hackford, the movie director, calls Keith Richards. "Hey, I'm doing, Chuck Berry's turning 60, and I'm going to do a film about him in St. Louis. Would you like to be the music director and put together a band for a couple of concerts that we're going to film for the film?" And so the first thing that popped into Keith Richards' head was what Ian Stewart told him. "Don't forget, Johnny Johnson's still alive and playing in St. Louis." And so Keith Richards basically insisted that Johnny be in the band for Hail Hail Rock and Roll. And Johnny got rediscovered as a result. And then, you know, Keith Richards hired Johnny to play on Talk Is Cheap. He produced Johnny's Grammy-nominated album, Johnny Be Bad, and performed on it and became one of Johnny's biggest supporters. I mean, when the Rolling Stones came to St. Louis, they would send a limo to pick up Johnny, and they showcased him at Busch Stadium. Same thing happened in Houston when they were all there at the same time. And, you know, so Keith Richards became, you know, the Holy Grail. I mean, that was the number one interview that I needed to get for this film, because he was the one that made sure that Johnny had a second career and didn't go back to driving a bus to make a living. He said, Johnny, you can't quit now. You got to keep playing. Get out on the road with a band. That's where you belong. And that's what happened. And had it not been for Keith Richards, none of those things would have happened. The challenge became, how do you get one of the Rolling Stones to pay attention to you? And it took me 4 years to get Keith Richards, not because he was hard to track down. He said yes immediately. But they were on a world tour, and his handler said, you'll have to be patient. And so 4 years later, I get a phone call or an email, I can't remember which. Be at Electric Lady Studios in Greenwich Village on such and such a date. You'll get 30 minutes with Keith Richards. Great. So I took vacation time, like I did the 28 times I traveled outside of St. Louis for the film. And there were 5 documentary crews there that day to interview Keith Richards. And I was number 3 in line. And I asked him a softball question to get the ball rolling. And he talked for 15 minutes straight about his good friend, Johnny Johnson. Suddenly my interview's half over and I've only asked one question. You know, so I got most of what I needed. The one story that I wish I had had time to ask him was when he and Mick Jagger were teenagers. They ran into each other on the elevated train, and Mick Jagger had a bunch of albums under his arm, including some Chuck Berry albums. And Keith Richards zeroed in on those Chuck Berry albums because he was a Chuck Berry fan too. And if you know anything about the history of the Stones, I mean, they were a Chuck Berry cover band before they became what they became. And so were the Beatles. So the two greatest bands in rock and roll were heavily influenced by, you know, the music of Chuck Berry and Johnny Johnson. So for all those reasons and more, you know, I decided to take this high risk, high reward project on. I knew it was going to be hard, and I probably underestimated it. But I have a film. I have a dozen Rock and Roll Hall of Famers in it, starting with Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. I'm sorry, Keith Richards and Eric Clapton, I should say. And now I'm in the music licensing phase, which is always the hardest phase. You know, and complicating the project is that Chuck Berry was not a fan of Johnny B. Goode, went out of his way to create roadblocks, including instructing his attorney before he died that he didn't want any of his music in my film. So I have to come up with dual ways of getting the music into the film, including fair use.
So if people have not yet, the website is johnnybegoodthemovie.com.
It's actually jjthemovie.com. That's probably the easiest way to get it.
jjthemovie.com. I did see that. We could do a whole podcast just on the documentary, but we got to move on. John Goodman does your voiceover. I mean, talking
actually,
about
John Goodman and Michael McDonald, I have co-narrators.
And like I said, we could do another hour on this, but we got to move on. Here's the one story I didn't want to skip, though. I got a theory, Art, in life. Like, you know how cool you are when one of the geekiest things you do is a hit or becomes popular. And so John Sebastian, who's pretty much known for Loving Spoonful, his main hit, he basically is on record as saying, oh, you think it's so hard to make a hit? Here, Welcome Back, Carter. So he writes this theme song. It's just nothing like anything Sebastian done. But when he gets elected into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he gives the statue to Johnny.
Well, I heard this story from a third person, and when I heard it, I was praying that it was true because it was such an amazing story. After the Lovin' Spoonful went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000, John Sebastian gave an interview to People magazine saying that he would have gladly delayed his induction if it meant that rock and roll pioneers like Johnny Johnson got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, he didn't stop there. He shipped his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame trophy here to St. Louis to Johnny's house. And I didn't, I, like I said, I heard this story from a third person. So now I got to get in touch with John Sebastian. So what do? I go to johnsebastian.com. And there's a contact button on there. Now I'm thinking, well, you know, this isn't going anywhere. He probably doesn't even check his email, or somebody else does, but I got nothing to lose. So I wrote him on johnsebastian.com, and he got back to me the next day, the one and only time that happened during this whole process. When I got him on the phone, I actually talked to his wife before I talked to him, and she goes, oh, yeah, that's a true story. And so finally I got Sebastian on the phone, and he goes, I don't know if I want to tell that story. You know, I don't want people to misunderstand. It's not about me. It's about someone I admire, someone who blazed a trail that made it cool to be a rock and roll performer. And I assured him that of all the Johnny Johnson stories I had already collected, that he had just moved to the top of the class. And so on the road trip of road trip, I drove to New York and I interviewed Eric Clapton. The next day I drove to Woodstock, New York, and I interviewed John Sebastian. And then later on, I drove to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and got Al Kooper. But when I first walked into John Sebastian's home, there was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame trophy. And I said, John, I'm going to hand you the trophy before I ask you the money question. It's your moment in the spotlight. You're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Why are you thinking about in a pure piano player that most fans have no idea who he is, even though they've heard his piano playing hundreds of times? And so he's holding the trophy and he's talking. And then he starts fumbling in his pocket and he's bumping my microphone with his hand. And I'm thinking, God, this guy's killing me. I'm not going to be able to use this audio. But he pulled out an index card. And it was the card that he had sent with the trophy to Johnny. And he started reading it, and the hair stood up on my arm. It was something to the effect of, to Johnny Johnson, hero to all Hall of Fame inductees. We know what you did. We won't forget. And I was blown away. Who does that? Who wins induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or wins an Oscar or a Tony and then goes to FedEx and ships it to somebody that inspires them? I mean, that's the kind of stuff you make up for a movie. It couldn't possibly be a true story. But John Sebastian's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame trophy was on Johnny Johnson's mantle for a year because Johnny went in the following year. So that's the best story in the film.
I'm so looking forward to it. So, all right, Proven, what, you're almost 66?
Next month, yeah, I'm weeks away from turning 66.
All right, so Proven, you still got game. 2 weeks ago, you drop, I'm 65, and we're talking about problems we talked about in 1954.
Right.
One, so Art, I see it without knowing the backstory. And the first thing I tell my wife is, man, I can't believe KSDK let them do it. And then I found out they actually came to you. So now I'm thinking, if it's me, Art, and I'm white and I'm not you, I'm a little nervous because I don't want to be a spokesperson. But then at the same time, I got something to say. So how'd this come about?
Well, it started with a social media post. I write even in my spare time, whether it's poetry, lyrics, essays. I just love writing. And I was trying to process a lot of the things that I was feeling after George Floyd was killed. And I just started writing. And it turned out pretty good. And so I put it on Facebook. And there was some salty language in it. And you know, my news director saw it, and she goes, that was really powerful what you wrote on Facebook. We'd really like you to do something for television. But obviously, you've got to clean up the language and, you know, that sort of thing. And I was reluctant for several reasons. One, I'm old school. I'm not the story. I tell the story. Other people are the story. But obviously, that's changed over time. And as she correctly pointed out, you know, I've got 40 years invested in this television market, and I've built up a lot of goodwill, and a lot of people pay attention to what I say, even though most of the time I'm reading other people's words. Suddenly I'm telling my own story, and I've used the metaphor that some of the personal stories that I told that I mentioned earlier in this conversation, you store in the attic because they're not really useful on a day-to-day basis, but you can't get rid of them because they're part of who you are. And so I told some painful stories from my past. And then I tried to use my writing ability, sometimes with a bit of sarcasm, to challenge the people watching it. What side of history are you going to be on? Are you going to be part of the solution or part of the problem? And the reaction was overwhelmingly positive. You know, I got some, you know, I got some pretty raw letters, you know, by some uninformed people that were borderline racist. But that's, you know, when you talk about race in this country, you always get pushback from the people who don't want things to change. And as we've seen day after day for weeks now, that may not be an option anymore. And the thing that's different this time around is that you have so many young white people who've been protesting day after day after day. And you had, in a relatively short period of time, you had the Aubrey situation, you know, a jogger getting run over because three men suspected him of being a burglar. You had the Breonna Taylor fiasco where the police had the wrong address and they wound up killing a first responder. And then you had George Floyd and the infamous 8-minute, 40-second video of what appeared to be a sociopathic police officer who knew he was being filmed and still took a man's life. And like every black person in America, I was affected by that. The difference this time is that a lot of people in general were affected by that. And that's one of the tipping points of society right now. Security cameras, body cams, and cell phones. If you can see it, you can't deny it. And what we saw in Minneapolis was unacceptable to millions and millions of people. And here we are. Now, what is the next chapter? I don't know. But, I mean, just in the last 3 weeks, there have been a lot of change. I mean, I never thought I would see the day that Roger Goodell would apologize on behalf of the National Football League and say they got it wrong with Colin Kaepernick. You know, that's when I knew things had changed. And then, you know, you've got the statues and you've got the demand for defunding the police and the demand for social change. And, you know, so you know, we're in a very tumultuous time. And, oh, by the way, a lot of people aren't paying attention to the pandemic. And so it's wreaking havoc on the Black community in this country. So here we are.
I think you got a book in you. Racism isn't getting worse. It's getting recorded.
You know, that's not an original thought, but it's true. The tipping point right now is video. The things that have happened in the last 3 or 4 weeks, none of that's new. There's been excessive force by police officers pretty much since the police began as slave patrols after the abolition of slavery. And the, you know, people have been coming to me, what should I read? What should I watch? I want to understand. The thing that I'm telling them is to watch a documentary called 13th by Ava DuVernay. She's one of the top directors in Hollywood. She directed Selma. But 13th is about the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery. But there's a loophole. Unless you're convicted of a crime. And it connects the dots between the days after slavery and the beginning of slave patrols, which eventually became our police forces, and the monetizing of arresting Black men, the prison industrial complex, and everything in between. And it is a phenomenal documentary. And so if anybody gets anything from what we've been talking about, it's on Netflix, and it came out several years ago, but it's blowing up again because a lot of people are watching it all over again and discovering it. But 13th tells the story in a way that it hasn't been told before.
Great stuff, Art. So we're wrapping up. You're signed on with Case to K through November 2021. Any idea what happens after that?
No, I don't. I think there's a possibility I'll retire. A lot of it just depends on how I feel. Yeah, basically how I feel. I can see retirement from here. I just don't know the exact timetable.
Very good. So, Art, when I was growing up, there was an ESPN anchor named Stuart Scott. You familiar with Stuart Scott? And he had a saying, which I think generally is Art Holiday in a nutshell, cooler than the other side of the pillow.
Well, the first person I heard say that was Jack Buck. So I don't know who the first was, but whoever came up with it first, that's one of the all-time great lines.
Enjoyed our time. Hope you had a good time.
No doubt, David. Thanks.
And there's another one for the books. I want to thank Art for his time. Obviously a great guy. If you want to check on his St. Louis 7, where I ask him 7 questions that only St. Louisans can answer, you can check out our YouTube channel. That's OT with Oliver. All the other St. Louis 7 episodes also up there. Hits keep on coming. Next week, Guy Phillips had a chance to sit down with a retired veteran radio icon. Had a good talk, and we'll do that on Sunday. So don't forget, subscribe. Have yourself a great week. As we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.